Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. While Washington was in the throes of shutdown, Secretary of State John Kerry was in Afghanistan this month talking about drawdown of American troops and what happens then. Despite brave talk of an orderly handoff to Afghan forces, historian and military analyst Stephen Biddle says we are at great risk of a Vietnam-style ending in Afghanistan, just a decent interval between U.S. withdrawal and the defeat of its local ally by the Taliban. He says cut a deal with the Taliban now or just go. Don't fail slowly. This hour on Point, leaving Afghanistan. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Are you still watching Afghanistan? Is it out of sight, out of mind? What will we leave there? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first today from Washington is Ben Pauker, managing editor of Foreign Policy magazine. He's been following the visit of Pakistan's Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif and more. Ben Pauker, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
President Obama and the Pakistani Prime Minister sitting down today. Drones have been getting a lot of attention. Amnesty International saying there may be war crimes here. What's at the top of the president's agenda with the Pakistani Prime Minister?
Well, I think they both come to the table with different concerns. There's lots on the agenda for both Sharif and President Obama today. You know, it's Sharif's first return to Washington in 14 years, and it comes at a unique time for Pakistan. There's been a warming of relations since the low days of 2011 after the Osama bin Laden raid and the scandal involving Raymond Davis, the CIA officer, who was expelled from the country and had to leave after killing two Pakistani civilians.
In the street?
In the street, exactly. Mm-hmm. And Sharif's an experienced politician. He's the head of Pakistan now for an unprecedented third time. And he brings with him this enormous popular mandate after a very successful, although not without some security issues, democratic transition there, which was the first time since Pakistan's independence that the government went from one elected official to another popularly elected president.
Ben, we're going to be talking about the U.S. drawdown and pullout of Afghanistan today. What's Pakistan's interest in that process and the way it's done?
Well, I think that there's a great deal of uncertainty for Sharif and Pakistan's security officials as to what the current force structure or the force structure post-2014 will be in Afghanistan. In several high-level conversations that I've had with Pakistani security officials, they've evinced that they really have no idea what the U.S. force structure will be. It's been mooted that it will be somewhere in the range of 5,000 to 10,000 U.S. soldiers to remain in Afghanistan. And Kerry was just there in October in the midst of the government shutdown to try and negotiate the bilateral security agreement with Karzai. And they say that they are close to a basic agreement, that they've reached a basic agreement on all of the key issues. But for the Pakistanis, they say it's very opaque. They really have no sense of what the U.S. forces will, what level of U.S. forces will remain in Afghanistan.
51,000 U.S. troops in Afghanistan now. That's dropping to 34,000 in February if all goes on schedule. And hypothetically to, you know, nearer zero by the end of the year. Does Pakistan favor a residual U.S. force in Afghanistan, Ben, or not?
I think what the Pakistanis want to see is some level of security. They have significant and serious doubts about the ability of the Afghan security forces to maintain security. They worry about Afghan security forces actually funding elements of insurgency within Pakistan, particularly in Balochistan, the restive province of which Quetta is the head. But so the Pakistani security officials say they see three possible outcomes after 2014. They see an inflamed civil war as the first possible outcome, with the Taliban and the Afghan government really coming to heads.
Mm-hmm.
The second is a negotiation that the elements of the Taliban come and sit down and they actually bring them into government. And the third is sort of a status quo ante position, where limited pockets of insurgency remain. The Taliban have hold over some areas, but the Afghan security forces generally control the majority of the country. And that third scenario is most likely, but obviously, it's an extremely unstable position and untenable in many respects for Pakistan.
And of course, as my guest Stephen Biddle will say today, that probably depends on very heavy long-term U.S. support. Who knows if that will be there? Let's look at drones for a moment. Amnesty International talking about, you know, grandmother picking okra in her field in Pakistan, killed by U.S. drone, and family members wounded there. They are raising this rubric of war crime on American drone use in Pakistan. First of all, to the Obama administration's response, interesting papers around the world using this war crimes phrase. I'm looking in the Washington Post reporting on this. I don't even see them using the phrase. Is the White House shaken by this, or is it steady as she goes, right on with more drone use?
Well, I think the White House statement has been what we expected, that they have defended the U.S. policy of drone strikes. As we know, it's significantly increased under the Obama administration, coming to a head of hundreds of strikes. In 2010, and there have been, the Amnesty Report investigated 45 strikes from a period of January 2012 to August 2013. There is significant difference in a number of different studies as to the amount of civilians killed, but clearly the targeted strikes have not been perhaps as targeted as the U.S. government has tried to make clear.
And those drone strikes primarily been at Al-Qaeda-associated targets in Pakistan or Taliban-associated targets that might have a more direct impact on the Afghan situation?
Well, I think these strikes, as we know, are kept in the utmost secrecy, both the targeting decisions and who's actually killed. The United States government has made clear that these are largely Al-Qaeda, but in the Northwest Frontier Province, many of these are Pakistani Taliban, TTP militants that have been targeted.
So here we are with drones on the table, Pakistan right across the border, and everybody now watching what the U.S. does in Afghanistan. Ben Pauker with Foreign Policy Magazine. Ben, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks.
Well, the country was in the thrall of shutdown. John Kerry, Secretary of State, was in Kabul talking with Afghan President Hamid Karzai about what kind of agreement, what kind of forces the U.S. may have in Afghanistan after a scheduled drawdown pull out in 2014. Working there on a bilateral security agreement, here's Kerry October 12th in Kabul at a news conference.
We have put ourselves in a position for an enduring partnership going forward in the years ahead, providing that the political process of Afghanistan accepts that. We respect completely the president's need, the president's right, the Afghan people's need to approve of whatever agreement might come forward.
Secretary of State John Kerry in Kabul, October 12th. Hamid Karzai had been very dismissive of some onward agreement with the United States. Secretary of State Kerry saying we've got a breakthrough here. With us right now from Washington is Stephen Biddle, Senior Fellow for Defense Policy at the Council on Foreign Relations, professor at George Washington University, contributed to a big essay to the current issue of Foreign Affairs magazine, headlined Ending the War in Afghanistan, How to Avoid Failure on the Installment Plan. Stephen Biddle, welcome back to On Point. Very good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having me.
There's our Secretary of State saying we're setting down the pillars of a long-term relationship here. You're writing in your piece that we may, on the contrary, be on a different path to a decent interval, sort of Vietnam style, between the United States withdrawal and the eventual defeat of its local ally. What's your concern, Stephen Biddle?
Well, the war on the ground is basically stalemated at the moment. I don't think the Taliban are going to march into Kabul after we withdraw in 2014, but neither is the Afghan security forces likely to be able to destroy the Taliban. So what we've got is a grinding stalemate that's sustainable as long as the U.S. Congress pays the bills to keep the Afghan forces in the field. The Afghan military, big enough to defend the country from the Taliban, is a lot bigger than the Afghan government is ever going to be able to pay for on its own. So we can sustain the stalemate, but only as long as the Congress pays the bills. And what that means is when you look out into the out years of this thing, the war becomes a contest in patience between the Taliban and the U.S. Congress. Whoever tires of this first ends up either losing outright or being forced to accept a deal on terms other than they would prefer.
You're suggesting the Taliban likely has more patience, the U.S. would be better to cut a deal now, or not go for this long-term paying for the Afghan government forces and just plain go.
Well, I think the meaningful choices for the United States at this point are negotiate or cut our losses. Now, it's very, very unlikely that we'll win this war militarily by the Afghan security forces destroying the Taliban. So eventually, no matter what you think of the prognosis, the end state for this thing is settlement, some kind of negotiation. I would prefer that we do the things we need to get a settlement on terms we can live with. Now, that settlement isn't going to occur tomorrow morning, even if we do those things. This is a very complicated negotiation. It's going to take years to work out. But if we don't start doing the homework we need now, if we don't start paying the political capital that we need to pay now to make the eventual terms of the deal something we can live with, what we'll end up with is just outright failure when eventually, sooner or later, the Congress does pull the plug. And at that point, we lose the ability to get a deal that we can live with.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Afghanistan, how we will get out, what we will leave behind. Pakistan, right next door. Stephen Biddle is with us at the Council on Foreign Relations and George Washington University, formerly held chair in military studies at the U.S. Army War College. Out with a big essay in the last couple of months in Foreign Affairs magazine, headlined "Ending the War in Afghanistan: How to Avoid Failure on the Installment Plan." Stephen Biddle, in your essay, there's a kind of presumption here that an awful lot of arrows point toward loss. Square that for us with the image and voice of John Kerry in Kabul just in the last couple of weeks, obviously working very hard to cut a deal for an extended U.S. presence in Afghanistan.
Well, I think Secretary Kerry probably would like to have a very long-term U.S. presence in Afghanistan. It's not entirely his decision to make. This turns on the willingness of the U.S. Congress to make the appropriations needed to pay the Afghan National Security Forces bills. And that, I think, is very difficult to project out in the long term, but it requires a very demanding set of assumptions about congressional patience for us to be able to outlast the Taliban. So, I mean, if you think that you're eventually going to get an end to this war that doesn't represent some sort of compromise settlement in which both sides give up something that they like in order to end the war, if you're going to get an outcome that doesn't involve that, somehow or another, you have to believe either that the Afghan security forces are going to be able to render the Taliban militarily non-viable, which is something that even a very large international presence has been unable to do in the last several years of a very large military effort, or that the Taliban finally say, we're tired of this, we give up, we simply surrender, and we'll agree to a deal in which we ask no concessions at all of the West. I think either of those two scenarios as long-term end states for this conflict are very unlikely.
Hamid Karzai has a big Loya Jirga coming up to talk about this longer-term deal with the United States. John Kerry investing a lot in. Are you saying that these negotiations, not with the Taliban, but with Hamid Karzai, are irrelevant? Or how do you look at them? Are they important strategically?
Well, they're certainly relevant and they're certainly important, if only because if they go badly, we lose quickly. I mean, if the bilateral security agreement talks collapse, as, for example, analogous talks collapsed in Iraq, there will be no U.S. military presence. If there's no U.S. military presence, I think there's a significant likelihood that the Congress would cut financial support as well. If the financial support for the Afghan National Security Forces from international sources goes away, there's no way the Afghan government can support a military big enough to protect the country. And in that case, you get a rapid collapse. So, I mean, the talks are relevant, but that's not to say that the talks, if they go well, can guarantee success. They can preclude failure. But if they do that, that just gets you into the problem of, okay, now how do I deal with the problem in the longer term?
We've been spending tens of billions of dollars a year in Afghanistan. If I'm reading you correctly, you're looking at a, I don't know, $3, $4, $5, $6 billion a year post a major U.S. drawdown to support Afghan security forces, it can look from this point in time like a bargain compared to what we're spending now.
And it is a bargain. If you compare the likely cost of a modest continued U.S. presence and U.S. support for Afghan national security forces to what we were paying, say, in 2011 to wage the war with mostly U.S. forces, you're talking about a bill that's smaller by perhaps even a factor of 10. So if the comparison that you think about is the comparison of what we used to spend in 2011, then it looks real cheap. The further we get from 2011, the less salient that comparison is going to become, and the more salient other comparisons then become, like, for example, the relative cost of what we're doing for Afghanistan and what we do for Israel. And the problem here is that there's a large, very vocal U.S. domestic political constituency for aid to Israel. There is not much in the way of a vocal U.S. domestic constituency for American aid to Afghanistan. Now, again, none of this is to suggest that the Congress is going to pull the plug next year. I think in the near term, the Congress will probably vote for whatever level of support the administration asks for. The problem is in the out years. As you get further and further from that big expenditure in 2011, and as you get further and further from a war in which American soldiers were waging combat operations, and in which you get more and more of the kinds of periodic crises in U.S.-Afghan relations that we've seen for most of recent history in the U.S.-Afghan relationship, you know, corruption scandals that hit the front page of the newspapers, Quran burnings that yield demonstrations and riots, Afghan soldiers that kill Westerners that are trying to train or advise them, periodic statements by an Afghan president that play to local political preferences and insult American sensitivities. If you look into the out years and you expect that there are going to be periodic difficulties of this kind, and the comparison to 2011 gets dimmer and dimmer in the rearview mirror, I think you're looking at a scenario in which the Congress eventually starts responding to these crises with shaves on the budget allocated to supporting Afghan security forces. And you don't have to shave that budget very much before it gets too small to support an Afghan military of the size that we have in the field today in the out years.
A lot of Americans have put Afghanistan on the back burner of their minds. Stephen Biddle is looking closely at it and saying, worst option here, losing slowly and very expensively over years with U.S. funding finally cut back after billions more spent. He says, let's look at it right now. Sort of fish are cut bait is one of the headlines in his piece. Stephen Biddle, please stand by in Washington. I want to go to Kabul, Afghanistan right now. And Sean Carberry, Kabul correspondent for NPR. Sean Carberry, thank you so much for joining us. What's the expectation at this point? I know you've got a Loya Jirga, the big council coming up, about whether the United States and Afghanistan can cut a near-term deal on what U.S. forces status would be there after 2014 if some stay. Is it clear where that conversation's going in Afghanistan, Sean?
Thanks, Tom. The conversation is heading towards a deal being final. For the last few months, there's been pretty strong support from members of parliament, from officials here, from Afghan people, saying that they want a deal. There was frustration expressed that President Karzai wasn't moving quickly enough to get the deal done. So there's certainly inertia towards the deal getting done, feeling that the next month will be a formality, that it's under President Karzai, so he will be able to influence it to approve the deal. At the same time, this is Afghanistan. Things can be unpredictable. There are other forces, neighboring countries, hoping to influence the debate. But certainly, the inertia is towards a deal getting done, and most people here want it.
Sean Carberry, Stephen Biddle says, get real, sooner or later you're going to have to do probably a deal with the Taliban, so let's do it now. What's the range of opinion in Kabul on some kind of negotiated deal sooner than later, rather than later, with the Taliban, Sean? Are they resistant to that? We'll have American support in the billions for many years, so we don't have to do it? Or are there significant elements in the power structure in Kabul saying, we'd better make a deal with them now while the Americans are still around?
Well, there have been efforts for really more than a year at this point to try to start negotiations with the Taliban. The Afghan Peace Council has made efforts and overtures. The U.S. looking for us. Part of the problem is the Taliban have not expressed a clear willingness to engage in. The Taliban aren't necessarily a united point. They're a military side, political side. They don't agree on what the some Taliban are better off waiting, not negotiating, letting international troops leave. They will have a better shot at ending the date militarily. Others know they're going to run out of steam at some point. They should talk. But the structural barrier, the Taliban don't want to talk with President Karzai. President Karzai wants Afghanistan to control the peace talks and is very concerned about the U.S. muscling in. So there have been conflicting interests that haven't been resolved. Acknowledge that there will have to be some type of political deal at some point.
Sooner or later, Sean Carberry, Kabul correspondent for NPR. It's always good to hear from you, Sean. Be well there, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Here's just a clip from the 2013 documentary, The Network. Here's an Australian editor, producer there, who working at the first post-Taliban television network in Afghanistan. It's kind of a sign or a pole of westernization, modernization in Kabul. Here she is talking about what life in Afghanistan might look like after U.S. troops, NATO troops, go.
I have great fears around what's going to happen. I have fears for these kids. Oh, I'm so sorry. No, I'm not. My fears for the future of this country is, it just breaks my heart to think these kids are going to be left here in the middle of a civil war.
Maybe. And who knows on what timetable. Stephen Biddle, please stand by. I want to turn to our listeners. Mike in Burlington, Vermont. Mike, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for having me. Mm-hmm. First of all, I am strongly against giving any more money to Afghanistan. Karzai is corrupt. Okay? I mean, it's like, I don't believe we should give anything to Pakistan. I think the troops should be home yesterday.
Would you rather have the Taliban in power in Afghanistan, Mike?
I don't really care because 9/11 was a conspiracy. Okay? All right? If you saw the Twin Towers go down, it was a controlled explosion.
Mike, we've got that view, and before it, let's get out. No more money. Thank you for your call. Christopher, Nashville, Tennessee. Christopher, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Christopher here. I started in Afghanistan in 2011, 2012 as a PSYOP soldier, and I have a really intimate working relationship with the Afghan forces. And what people don't realize, in Afghanistan, there are good people.
Sure.
There are people who are scared. They are people who can't defend themselves. And these Taliban, these terrorists, they come in and they just take over. They kill, they try to recruit to make their forces stronger. So as the United States government, we've started something. We've made a lot of progress. We've made a lot of ground. They don't need much. They don't need much at all. We just need to give them a little to sustain themselves. When we pull out, there are things in place like the Afghan local police who knows what citizens belong in the different neighborhoods and what people are part of the Taliban. There are things in place that they can sustain on their own once we do go.
So don't leave them hanging, you're saying, Christopher. And you've been there. Stephen Biddle, how do you respond to that? We've invested a lot. There are clearly people who would resist the Taliban there. You've got Michel Flournoy, I'm reading here, in Foreign Policy, saying, you know, there's a solid chance of Afghanistan becoming significantly more stable, productive, self-sustaining. Don't abandon it now. What do you say to that sentiment, that view, Stephen?
I would strongly prefer that we get a negotiated settlement that preserves both American national security interests in this conflict, but also the interests and the rights and the future of Afghan civil society and the Afghan people. The issue is, are we going to do what we need to do now to make that kind of a settlement possible? Because I think if we don't get a settlement along lines that we can live with, the result is very unlikely to be an Afghan government that's going to win this war, on its own, But B, even with financial support from the West, I think the most they can plausibly do, notwithstanding the fact that there are many Afghan soldiers and police who are willing to fight, many Afghan people who will support the kind of democratic government, corrupt as it may be, that now exists in Afghanistan, notwithstanding all of that, there's very little evidence to suggest that this government and this Afghan military are going to be able to win the war after our troops are no longer engaged in combat missions there. And that ends up putting us back in an environment where our only meaningful choices, if the Afghan government can't actually win, are try and manufacture a settlement that's better than outright defeat, or at least if defeat is what we're looking at in the long term, make it less expensive than it could be otherwise.
President Obama suggested that this is the field of battle in which the United States cannot lose. It, for deep security reasons, it cannot afford to lose here. What about that assertion?
Well, I mean, I think the administration's assessment of the interests at stake here are that they're real, but that they're limited, that this is not World War II against Nazi Germany, that there are security interests for the United States involved that matter, but what the administration has been trying to do is to find some way of waging the war that's considerably less forceful than it would be if they really believed that defeat is simply not an option, failure is simply not an option, we'll do whatever it takes to avoid failure in Afghanistan. We would be much more heavily invested militarily in this war if that were actually the interest calculus that the White House held going forward. Instead, what I think the administration has been trying to do is find some way of waging the war that's limited in scale, limited in scope, and limited in sacrifice, but real, and thus whose level of effort kind of matches or is commensurate somehow with the real but limited stakes we have in the conflict. And the problem is that sort of centrist, moderate, reasonable way of waging the war hasn't been sufficient to actually prevail in that war. And that's what leaves us in the situation that we find ourselves in now.
So we'll be looking at billions a year indefinitely, you're saying, to keep some kind of status quo that prevents the Taliban takeover. And you just don't believe the United States will stick with that over time.
I think we'll stick with it for a while, but for that strategy without a settlement to be sufficient to prevail, you've got to make some pretty heroic assumptions about the relative willingness of the U.S. Congress to expend effort and the relative willingness of the Taliban to stick it out. I mean, it's a cliche that the Taliban are very fond of. The Americans have the watches, that we, the Taliban, have the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's suggestive of just how patient they're prepared to be.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Afghanistan, how we'll get out and what we'll leave behind. Pakistan right next door. Stephen Biddle joins us, formerly the U.S. Army War College, now with the Council on Foreign Relations and a professor at George Washington University. Big essay in the September-October issue of Foreign Affairs, headlined Ending the War in Afghanistan, How to Avoid Failure on the Installment Plan. Afghans talking about what kind of deal to cut with the U.S. post-2014 when U.S. troops, NATO troops, are scheduled to go. Here was Afghan President Hamid Karzai earlier this month in Kabul standing beside U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry about the Loya Jirga, the council coming up of Afghans to consider.
The issue of jurisdiction is beyond the authority of the Afghan government. It is only and entirely up to the Afghan people to decide upon through two mechanisms. One is the traditional Loya Jirga of Afghanistan. The second is the constitutional mechanism, which is the Afghan parliament.
The issue of jurisdiction, i.e., what law would U.S. troops be under after a NATO drawdown there? The United States insists on them being under American jurisdiction. That was the sticking point with Iraq. U.S. troops out of there. Would drones be the answer once the U.S. is gone? A lot of heat on that front this week. Amnesty International calling some American drone killings in Pakistan right next door war crimes. Here is White House spokesman Jay Carney responding to that, and the Human Rights Watch charges as well at a press briefing yesterday. You'll notice he doesn't actually use the word drones to describe drone strikes.
U.S. counterterrorism operations are precise, They are lawful and they are effective. Before we take any counterterrorism strike outside areas of active hostilities, there must be near certainty that no civilians will be killed or injured.
Not hard to imagine U.S. drums active over Afghanistan after an American drawdown. Stephen Biddle in Washington, lots of callers for you. James in Columbia, South Carolina. James, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
I've left it off.
Hello, James. You're on the air.
Just say, hey, Tom, thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
You know, I retired from the military. I joined in 85.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of soldiers are kind of getting tired of losing a war based on popular opinion. You know, if you look at a Taliban or the first people that have been, that have attacked American soil since the Revolutionary War, and Americans just gave up. You cannot negotiate with the Taliban. They're going to agree with whatever you want. They'll move back in, and the police force and the Afghan army cannot do the mission. I mean, a lot of the Taliban have infiltrated the military there. Those are the ones that are attacking the American soldiers and other forces over there. So instead of giving up, I think we need to put more emphasis on it and actually try to eradicate it as much as the Afghan
independence. James, I've got that perspective. How many years would you be willing to spend? It's been a dozen years already. You're saying public opinion. I guess you mean American public opinion is pulling the plug here. How long would you spend to try and do it? How many billions?
Well, you got to look at it this way. We're going to spend billions trying to secure our borders to defeat the Taliban or any other insurgency trying to come in and attack us again on American soil. So where do you want to spend the billions? If we eradicate the Taliban, we might be able to be more relaxed on our security on the borders. I mean,
James, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Of course, it was Al-Qaeda that attacked on 9/11, but the Taliban created a situation where they could gather their forces and plans in Afghanistan, no question about that. Stephen Biddle, what do you say to this perspective? A soldier retired who's tired of losing.
Well, I mean, if the Taliban are obviously a horrible organization and very close to the last people in the world one would like to engage in a compromise negotiation with. But the alternative to doing that is making the kind of military effort that would be required to make the Taliban's military position in Afghanistan nonviable. The United States government has been unwilling to do that. Even the Obama administration, which substantially reinforced, roughly tripled the troop count in Afghanistan relative to their predecessors in the Bush administration, has proven to be unwilling to make the kind of military investment required to resolve the war without some sort of a negotiated settlement. So I think that just leaves you in a situation where your options are pretty limited.
Can we clarify what you mean?
Having to accept something.
Yeah, can we clarify what you mean by unwilling to make the investment? I mean, there was a big surge, as you say, 2011, very expensive, many tens of billions of dollars there. It sounds like a large investment.
Large, but evidently not large enough. The Taliban have not been put in a position today where they're not militarily viable in the country. They still control strategically important real estate, especially in the eastern part of Afghanistan, but also in some parts of the south. The surge was a major reinforcement, but it wasn't large enough to render the military problem to be handed off to the Afghans small enough that the Afghans could solve it on their own.
I can imagine our caller James thinking, all right, then let's make that investment. I mean, what would it take, or is it even really ultimately possible to do that, Stephen?
I think it's certainly possible, but it would require levels of investment that I don't think at the moment either party in the U.S. political system is willing to make. Certainly, it would require much more than the 100,000 American troops for several years that the Obama administration proved willing to invest. If at this point, it's a bit academic, I say mm-hmm. this as an academic,
yeah.
to speculate about how many more American troops, if you're going to reinforce, would it take to solve this problem without having to make concessions to the Taliban? Because I see very, very little appetite on either side of the aisle for reinforcing at this point. I think the left and right bounds of the political debate on Afghanistan and Washington at the moment are how much will we go down,
yeah.
not will we reverse trajectory and start reinforcing again.
Chris in Owensboro, Kentucky. Chris, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I appreciate the opportunity to express my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
I also thank you for having this conversation. Just had a quick observation, I guess, more than anything else, and would like to get comments on it. It seems like part of this conversation is like a feeling that this is something that could be won.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have that same assumption. When you're dealing with evils, whether it's by the name of Taliban or whether it's any other name you want to put to it, unless you round everybody up and teach the children some other way of life for multiple generations, you can't take that out of them. You can't beat it out of them. And I just want to see what comments you had on that.
I appreciate your call, Chris. I mean, Stephen Biddle, call it evil or call it Afghans, of ethnic stripes who just don't want the Russians there or the Americans there or have a religious view or, you know, they want a religious government in Afghanistan. Call it what you will. It's easy to sympathize with Chris thinking, look, you know, this kind of sentiment has been there for centuries. No foreign invader, please. No foreign military presence. Taliban's across the border in Pakistan. Even if you defeat them in Afghanistan, I mean, wouldn't it just come back?
Well, I mean, it's important to recognize that the Taliban are not naturally popular in Afghanistan. There's a perception in some parts of the American debate that the Taliban are the natural government of Afghanistan and we're just standing in the way. I mean, foreign military forces aren't popular either. But the Afghan population has been very heavily polled since 2001. This is one of the most surveyed political populations on the face of the earth. And in no poll of which I am aware have the Taliban ever gotten more than about 15% to 20% support nationally in Afghanistan, and it's usually a lot lower than that. Whereas the foreign military presence, which isn't naturally popular, mm-hmm. was nonetheless accepted by Afghans, the overwhelming majority, for the great majority of the conflict. I think Afghans have recognized that a foreign military presence, that other things being equal they don't like, has been what has stood between them and a Taliban that they like even less. So if you were to get in a time machine and go back and remake some of the foundational decisions that have been made about the conduct of the war in the last, you know, decade, let's say, given that you're fighting against an opponent that is as unpopular across the majority of Afghanistan as the Taliban in fact are, I think if the resource level had been significantly bigger than it was, but not infinitely large, 150,000, 160,000 American troops perhaps without a time limit on their withdrawal, I think it is plausible to suppose that what we could have done is gradually lever the Taliban out of any major presence in Afghan population areas, even relatively small ones, and force them back to a safe haven presence in Pakistan, but nothing more than that, and set up a situation in which the negotiation that would have to take place, and almost any imaginable end to this war eventually requires some sort of negotiation, mm-hmm. but that negotiation's terms would have been much more favorable to us and much less in the nature of a two-sided compromise. And our ability to persuade the Taliban's Pakistani backers to go along with this would have been greater because we could have suggested to the Pakistanis with some credibility that we are not going to simply withdraw in the midst of an ongoing war and leave an enormous mess on Pakistan's western border. But in fact, the country is militarily stable, if not completely pacified, and thus a deal on substantially Western favorable terms and substantially Afghan government favorable terms would probably solve Pakistan's primary worry about Afghanistan as well, that the government there is going to collapse and that the chaos on the Afghan side of the border would destabilize Pakistan in turn.
Of course, all that's history now. Can you just explain, if public support for the Taliban is only 15% to 20%, I mean, it's easy to find object lessons, even in this country, on how a minority can really have a lot of sway in a country. But how does the Taliban with 15, maybe, or 20% support in Afghanistan always get talked about in terms of a potential, mortal threat to the existing government? How can it overthrow the government with 15% support?
Well, A, again, I think as long as the West keeps the Afghan military in the field, they're not going to topple the Afghan government.
Take the West out of it if it's 15% support. Why does it even require foreign intervention to keep the Taliban out of power?
I think there are two primary reasons. One, of course, is the support of the Pakistanis, who view the Taliban as their plan B in the event that the Afghan counterinsurgency project collapses. But also the other reason has to do with the nature of the current Afghan government and the scale of corruption that it engages in. And in particular, the Afghan government and a variety of sub-governmental patron-client networks that operate under the political cover of the government are actively predatory in significant parts of the country. They transfer resources from the Afghan population to the members of the patron-client network. And in particular, in important parts of the country, they engage in land grabs in which they run people off their land in order to use that land in what have often turned out to be fraudulent economic development schemes designed to get bad loans out of Kabul Bank, for example, for members of the patron-client network. And what that does is it creates a radically disenfranchised minority in Afghanistan. The people who have been radically preyed upon by the government, who are not the majority of the population, but they're a minority that has nowhere to turn.
Yeah.
They believe that the Afghan police are controlled by the patron-client network, the local government is controlled by the patron-client network, the courts are controlled by the patron-client network, and they think that we're in cahoots with it. They want their land back, they want their property back, but they have nowhere to turn within the legitimate Afghan governing system that isn't part of the corrupt network that took it. And what they do then, of course, is they turn to the Taliban, who are not generally popular, but who are believed to be honest, if brutal, and who very astutely position themselves as defenders of the downtrodden. And the downtrodden are often people who've been preyed upon by the Afghan government. So that minority of the Afghan population, although they're relatively small in percentage terms, is large enough that when they grant voluntary access to their communities to Taliban fighters, the Taliban get access to areas in ways that make it possible for them to plant roadside bombs, assassinate officials, ambush patrols. And that's created a situation in which it's very difficult to render them militarily non-viable, unable to do the kinds of things I mentioned a moment ago, without substantially greater investments of military force than we've made. But this in turn points to the question of what we would have to do in order to solve this problem through a negotiation.
Well, let's talk about that, the substance and the timetable. U.S. troops are only going to be there in big numbers for another year or so.
Well, I think that's right. And there's not going to be a deal in a year or so, regardless of how aggressively we push it, for a variety of reasons. There's an Afghan election coming up, we hope, in April, maybe later. Mm-hmm. The Taliban aren't going to negotiate with lame ducks. They're probably going to make another try at winning the war militarily after the West is completely gone after 2014. So what we've got is this period of several years in which the talks aren't going to go anywhere, in which we need to be doing the homework that we're not doing right now to make a deal workable when the time eventually comes. And one of the key things we need to do to make a deal workable is to get on with the business of Afghan governance reform to try and at least cap the scale of corruption in the country. Because if we don't manage to do that, and this gets back to one of the points that I believe James, the caller, raised about whether or not any deal with the Taliban would be respected by the Taliban. Can we make the terms sustainable? Mm-hmm. Any deal that's imaginable will have to legalize the Taliban as a political actor and make it possible for them to compete in the Afghan political marketplace for votes and for positions. They'll lose that competition in the near term, which is one of the reasons why a deal would also require some sort of set-aside for the Taliban. Otherwise, there's no way they'd participate. But in the longer term, if the Afghan government continues to increase the scale of predation that they engage in, sooner or later, a Taliban that isn't liked but is at least viewed as honest will start being able to compete successfully with the non-Taliban alternatives in the Afghan political system, and a deal could eventually collapse, and the Taliban in the out years could, through the ballot box, get scales of control that they would never be able to get through bullets in wartime. What we need to do now in order to avert that danger and make a deal sustainable is start getting serious about governance reform and capping the scale of corruption. That's a key piece of the homework that needs to happen before we can actually negotiate a workable deal.
We've got less than a minute. I can imagine a lot of Americans rolling their eyes saying, with U.S. clout falling, with our pullout approaching, the leverage to do that seems small. Are you serious when you say, if you can't set the table for negotiations, just go, just get out, don't try, let them settle?
The worst outcome is not losing, it's losing expensively. If we're not going to do the things required to get a deal that can work, we should at least try not to lose expensively.
And what would that mean? Do you really mean, like, hey, you know, wheels up, we're out of there?
This is not the policy I prefer. I prefer negotiation. But if we're not serious about doing the homework we need to do to make a negotiation work, better to have the unavoidable happen with fewer additional American lives lost and fewer tens of billions of American taxpayer dollars directed to this problem.
Dear listeners, there is seriously contemplated context for you as we all watch what happens in the year ahead. Stephen Biddle, thank you very much for being with us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.